Not on, there we go. Bring this meeting of the House State Affairs to order. Today we have three items on our agenda. The first is SB 90, Alaska Territorial Guard Day. The second item is HB 34, expungement of set asides, and then we'll be working on PERS-TERS, basically the healthcare issues, the House Bill 238, and the healthcare initiative there, and we'll be looking at the other initiatives on healthcare as well. So we're ready on Tuesday, just so that everybody knows up front, what we'll be doing is having a presentation by the sponsor of SB 141. That'll be a PowerPoint, and we will be, you know, looking at that, investigating all the questions. Then we will recess to the call of the chair, which will be Tuesday evening, and we'll come back for public testimony. I imagine we'll have Tuesday evening, and we will have probably teleconference testimony from across the state on the issue. And then we will continue on, because we're going to just run out of time during the normal day. So is there anything else to come before the committee? I did want to recognize that Representative Elkins, Representative Gardner, Representative Lynn, Representative Gruenberg, and myself, Seaton, are present. And Representative Gatto is excused. And we are also joined by Representative Mike Kelly, up here, not as a committee member, but as a member of the House. And so, does anybody have anything for the committee? Okay, we have before us Senate Bill 90, and Senator Huggins, would you present the bill to us, and we'll be happy to consider.
Yes, thank you very much, Chairman Seaton and committee members. Today what I'd like to do, I think this is common sense, straightforward, but it would be only fair that the guy that's done the heavy lifting in this bill, my good friend and colleague Ryan Moore, that he present that. Let me just give you a thumbnail sketch of Ryan, though. He's a young guy that graduated from high school here very recently, very bright, was lined up to go into the Air Force in a foreign language area of discipline, and had some health difficulties. And you know, we were lucky enough to get him on our staff here representing rural Matsu and Chugiak. And Ryan has done a yeoman's job on this, and it would be certainly well beyond my capability to do what he can do as far as representing this bill. So I'd like to turn it over to Ryan.
Thank you. And would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you. My name is Ryan Moore, staff to Senator Huggins, and I thank you for the introduction. And thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm going to give a brief overview. You have the sponsor statement, which has a pretty good brief little history. I just want to point out some key points. The members of the Alaska Territorial Guard numbered 6,500, and they were predominantly Alaskan Native, and they were formed over 60 years ago. So this bill is a long time coming in honoring these members. The reason that we chose October 18th as the day of Alaska Territorial Guard Day is that was the first day, it happened last year, that the members of the Territorial Guard were recognized as United States veterans by the Army. So that's basically about it. I'm here for any questions that you might have.
Great. And Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Just out of curiosity, do you know how many of the original members of the Territorial Guard are still living?
Not many. I think I've heard about 300.
Probably plus or minus one or two of 300. And uh-huh. If I might add, and they're going fast.
Yeah.
When we originally submitted the names of the first 25 test cases, before those applications were approved for the discharge certificates, three of them passed away.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure it would mean a lot to them. They're men who are in their 80s,
yes.
Men and women.
Yes.
For the record, that was Senator Huggins,
right.
and Representative Gardner. Excuse me. We have trouble with the record if we just have conversations back and forth. So, Representative Gardner, sure.
Thank you. I'm sure it would mean a lot to them, and probably, as Representative Lynn points out, to their children.
Well, and the other thing that I might add, just to emphasize how quickly these people are passing, of the first 20-something that were have been awarded, five of those people have passed away since they've received the award. And I might add, one of your colleagues in the House, Representative Moses, was in the Territorial Guard at 13 years of age. So it's a monumental thing in the life of Alaska, but most particularly when you go to rural Alaska and you talk to Alaska Natives, their ears will pop up, their heads will fly up with great pride, and they will start talking to you about their grandfather, their aunt, their uncle, and there were a number of females, too. One of the first people recommended in the test group was a female.
Thank you. Representative Kelly?
I won't testify or anything, sir. I just was going to say that I had a cousin, Joe Kelly, that was associated with the Guards.
Yeah, and that's exactly what you get right there. Yeah. I had, because the history is there.
Representative Elkins?
I think Bob and I are sitting here with a great deal of envy that he thought of this before we did.
On that point,
Representative Lynn.
On that point, my mind is going now about Guard and Reserve.
And one thing that I should note is that I believe this is available for cross-sponsorship. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. And we would certainly encourage and welcome that and be honored.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
There's a family in Anchorage that is the Marston family. Brooke, father, the McDuck's son.
McDuck Marston.
Blythe, the granddaughter, who's an attorney. I know they'd be very honored to
Yes, and
this.
You know, we're working our way towards, and we're going to, we have a plan to do some honoring of the Marston family, and would like to be inclusive in that, and much along the lines of what we did with Representative Moses, because it is. I mean, that was, when you think about, those people went to the sound of the guns. That simple.
Are you, Representative Elkins, did
I
you have?
Anything else, no.
Okay. Is there any further questions? Is there anyone to testify on Senate Bill 90 in the audience? Is there anybody online? We have no. I'll close the public testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lynn.
When you're ready, I'll make a motion to move this out.
Seeing no further discussion.
Mr. Chair, it's my honor to move CS with Senate Bill 90, State Affairs. 24-LS-049/1 with individual recommendations.
And attached fiscal notes.
And attached fiscal notes. I didn't know we had one.
Yes, we do.
Attached fiscal notes.
Very good. Is there any objection to moving this bill? Seeing no objection, the bill moves from committee. Thank you very much, yep. Senator and Ryan. Yep.
Thank you.
Appreciate
thank
you very much. Him.
We will now go to House Bill 34. And we're waiting Representative Wyrock. And good morning.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Linda Sylvester, and I'm Representative Wyrock's staff.
Linda, would you go ahead and present the bill? And again, that's HB 34 that we have before us. Before we start, Representative Grunberg, would you move the CS that we have?
Yes, sure. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move, for discussion purposes, CS for House Bill 34 that's presently blank, number 24-LS0240/Y, dated 4/15/05.
Is there any objection to moving this for as a working bill for the committee? Seeing none, we have before us the committee substitute House Bill 34, version Y. Does everyone have the?
No, I need.
It's here.
Well, she says it's here.
No.
She says it's not here.
Sometimes here. It was on.
You have an extra copy there?
We got it.
Okay, the committee has the bill now. Go ahead, Linda. And again, would you introduce yourself for the record?
Linda Sylvester, staff for Representative Wyrock. It's been about a month when before or since Representative Wyrock presented the bill, so I would like to just kind of put it in context what the bill does. Current Alaska statutes provide for a set aside when you're in the criminal system and you meet certain circumstances. A statute since 1965 have allowed for that conviction to be set aside. It was a judicial tool that was intended to liberate the person of some of the consequences or impediments of a criminal record. The idea is that if somebody made a mistake and they have they've rehabilitated themselves, then they move on, and then the court system has allowed this this process to so that they can move forward and become productive citizens. Many people, including some judges, have always assumed that the set-aside meant that they walk away from the criminal conviction. And in 1995, there was a Supreme Court decision that stated, actually, that it's not really the case. And it's become a problem, or it's just more of an issue or a thorn in people's sides, because criminal convictions are discoverable on applications for when you're renting an apartment or on your credit references, when you're getting jobs. And a lot of people, you probably have anecdotal stories where people have, one example is a woman in Florida who contacted us. She was 20 years old and she worked for a store, and she gave away merchandise and was charged for criminal theft. And she's now in her 30s and has moved on and is a professional. And she can count on her fingers how many really nice jobs she was disqualified for, because when she was a very young, irresponsible person, she made this mistake. That's what the expungement statute that we're proposing would do. It would enable the set-aside to actually do what we thought it was supposed to do, let somebody kind of walk away from the record of their criminal conviction. The set-aside is handed out by a judge, and the expungement statute would follow that process. It just breathes life into the set-aside. And the first bill that we proposed was just a rough shell. And the one that we have before us is discusses how the process would take place. And I'll just walk you through that. The existing set-aside statute states, upon the discharge by the court without imposition of sentence, the court may set aside the conviction and issue to the person a certificate that, and today the certificate does really nothing. You get a certificate stating that you had a set aside. The expungement bill goes further, and it states, it would provide that under the law, the person has not been convicted of a crime. It provides that there's a 2-year window of opportunity that a person, after 2 years and the person hasn't gone to request this expungement, then the window is closed, so essentially it's a statute of limitations. And then it continues, the court shall issue an order if the court finds that the person is not likely to reoffend. It was important to make sure that judges had some kind of control over the issuance of an expungement order. And the set-aside, there is a standard. A judge would look at a person and issue the set-aside if it's in the interest of justice. And so there is some control that the judge would retain. The court must state that the effect of the order under the state law is that the person has not been arrested, adjudged, convicted, or received a suspended imposition of sentence or a set-aside unless the person reoffends. What this does is, if you have an expungement, many states do have, and in fact the federal government has an expungement statute for certain federal crimes. If you have an expunged crime, then the person is told that they can present themselves to society as being essentially free of that conviction. So what does that person do when they're faced with an application for an employment? You know, and they say, have you ever been convicted of a misdemeanor? Well, under the state statute, we've analyzed that this person made a mistake and they're not likely to reoffend, and in the interest of justice, we can let him go. We can let him move on. So we're telling him that he can check no on that. And some states have taken that step, including Washington State, of telling the person in the statute that how he can answer that question, because it's such a difficult thing. Yes or no. And again, the person is totally at liberty to follow their own conscience. The next thing is, the person shall provide the order to the Department of Public Safety and the clerk of the court, along with payment for cost of the sealing of the record. Department of Public Safety is mentioned because of the absent criminal justice record system, the online system, so that the Department of Public Safety can modify their records. The department and the clerk of the court shall seal all records pertaining to the arrest, judgment, suspended imposition of sentence, and the set aside. The records sealed may be accessed only by law enforcement or court officers for the purposes of investigating crimes or assisting with criminal prosecutions. Again, there are appropriate uses for the retained record. The interest is the person's posture towards society, and there are valid reasons why the record would need to be retained and available in situations like for prosecutors for different reasons. And I guess there is a policy decision of circumstances where some expungent orders totally erase the conviction. Other state statutes allow that to be readily accessible by the criminal justice system. Representative Wyrock's position is that our expungement statute should go far and should allow the person to have the record totally erased. And if you recall from the first version of the bill, the language included destroy all records, all copies, burn it, totally eliminate it. But that presented some problems. Number one, the criminal justice system has an interest in retaining these records. The records would be sealed. Number two, the records, you can't physically destroy all of the records. Every day, the courts disseminate information over the computer on disks on different databases, and it would be physically impossible for them to collect that information back. And hence the public safety fiscal note was discussing the expense, the impossibility of that process. And one thing that our bill doesn't actually mention is language stating that the state really isn't liable, can't be held responsible for information that was disseminated or broadcasted in the world prior to the date of the expungement. And that would be something we would add, and I have language for a conceptual amendment for that as well. And that is basically the presentation. Doug Wolliver's online, and I've worked with him with language and continue to work with him on different on language of this. And I think the idea before you is the public policy decision of is this in the interest of society and your constituents who are seriously impacted by mistakes that have happened years ago, and that bears no reflection on the type of people that they are today, and in society with the age of the information age, these are serious liabilities. Most people assume that an employer or someone who's renting an apartment will be able to weigh the this happened a long time ago, he's a good person, but that's not what happens. Is someone is going through a stack of applications and they see conviction and they put them in the reject file, and that problem is just increasing. So it's just a little bit of grace that we would like to offer society.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvester. We have a question. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Ms. Sylvester. We have documents in our files that aren't necessarily part of the record right now. Could you just explain what kinds of crimes are excluded from the possibility of set-asides and expungement, just for the record?
For the record, Linda Sylvester, staff to Representative Wyrock. It's the expungement is tied to the crimes that the statute allows for set-asides, and the crimes that are excluded are major crimes. Drunk driving is excluded. Any degree of homicide is excluded. Manslaughter, whether it's justified or not, is excluded. Kidnapping is excluded. although non-custodial interference could be set aside. Thank you. That crime, it could be set aside. And then excluded would be reckless endangerment, stalking, robbery, all forms of sexual assault are incest, unlawful exploitation of a minor, indecent exposure, arson. So the major crimes are, and again, these are tied to the set-aside statute.
So just a further explanation, this bill takes those crimes that have been set aside or that a judge does set aside, which excludes all of the major crimes that you just talked about because they cannot have a set aside, and then would allow those to be basically forgiven or eliminated from the record as far as a conviction goes. But those would be the minor crimes not talked about in your list.
Okay, right.
Thank you. Representative Lynn, did you have a question?
Well, I guess I do. I'm struggling with this. You know, we all want to forgive and forget. But you say that it's in the interest of society, mm-hmm. I believe in your testimony, but how is it in the interest of society to put a blindfold on society so they don't know what's happening? Because I was always taught, and common sense tells me, and experience tells me, that actions have consequences.
Through the chair, Representative Flynn, that's true. But there are times, I guess the judgment call of the committee is that society has moved, is moving increasingly to the point where someone can commit a minor infraction of the law and society will never let them move on from that. A situation, and it, just an example of what we're talking about is someone's a friend of a friend's child was in a cab driving from the airport and was in a dispute with a cabbie, and the cabbie charged him with theft of services, and he was convicted. Forevermore, that crime would follow him on any background check, any reference check. And so is it in the interest of justice for society, for this person, for a judge to look at this individual and say, yeah, let's let this one go?
Follow-up, Representative?
Just one quick. I know that, you know, I think we've all seen it when we've applied for various things. Mm-hmm. Has ever been convicted of a crime? Mm-hmm. And usually it says, if so, explain the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Where you could explain that this was something, as you just mentioned, that, quote, minor, and of course minors in the eyes of the beholder, mm-hmm. may be a misdemeanor rather than a felony, mm-hmm. but to the victim it may not be so minor.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Lynn, that's true, that that there might be people out there that look at circumstances, and but most often that's not the case. They're looking at raw data, and no one is interested in the circumstances. And over and over again, people have those anecdotal stories and it's exasperation. It's for God's sakes, I did that when I was 20 years ago when I was just footloose and fancy free, and now I'm an attorney. How come this thing just follows me? And our set aside statute leads people to believe that they walk away from it, and but that's not the case. It really does nothing. You get a certificate, but it does nothing. And the Supreme Court case explained that it's misleading. What it leads out is the actual word expungement. So it appears that early on in Alaska, we wanted to allow people an opportunity to reform themselves and walk away from things, but it just didn't have legs.
Okay. Thank you. And so again, this only applies to those things that a court has decided that there's going to be suspended imposition of sentence. And is suspended imposition of sentence the same thing as setting aside? Or is
Doug
providing the, I guess I should say, suspended imposition of sentence generally says that if you don't reoffend within a certain length of time, then this goes away. But what you're telling us is that even though that's what we think suspended imposition of sentence is, it goes away, but it really doesn't go away. It stays there on the books forever, and the intent of this is to take it, that suspended imposition of sentence, if you don't reoffend within the time that the court has delayed, then it would go, actually go away.
Correct. In the Journey case, this the court wrote that judges were even telling people that they walk away from it, that it was over and done with, and the plaintiff in the Journey case himself was shocked that it didn't, because why can't I never get a job? I completed the sentence. I was good. I did everything the judge said. I've never offended again. It was an unusual thing that happened in the first place, and the judge told me that it was going to go away. And mysteriously, you know, he never was ever able to get hired, and he looked into it, and it was because of the conviction and his misunderstanding. It was a systemic problem with the judicial system, that everyone assumed that the set-aside actually did what an expungement would do.
Okay, thank you. Representative Grunberg.
I have a number of questions, Linda. This last night was the first chance I really had to look at the bill. And I am concerned. First, I'll give you my broad views, and I'll get down to some of the details. First of all, let it be said I strongly support the policy behind the bill. I see a large number of problems with the bill as it's currently drafted. And I'm concerned that we don't have anybody here from the Department of Law to talk about some of the issues. I'd like to get a copy of that case or get the citation of the Supreme Court case. We don't have anybody here from the Department of Public Safety, and there's a fiscal note that has raised a lot of problems. And we do have Doug Willover from the court system. But I'd like to start with a technical problem.
And Representative Grunberg, before we go on, since we just got this, and we do not have a revised fiscal note from the troopers who raised a number of issues, it's not my intention to move this bill today.
Okay.
So what I would like to do is get amendments introduced so that when we go to the troopers, the court system, they will know the bill that we are asking for a fiscal note on, and we can get back. Because I would feel very uncomfortable moving this bill without having the people that generate the fiscal notes and the comments having the new bill before them, because it's quite different, and it's addressed some of those issues but not all of them. So
and I would offer to work with you and with Representative Wyrock on this. I have you got a copy of the amendment that I've distributed?
Mm-hmm.
Here. Yep. Peter, why don't you give her a copy of this? One thing I'm concerned about, and this is a reason I'd like to get law involved in this, usually for issues that the defendant has more within their own knowledge, they have what's called the burden of proof on. And here what you have on page 1, line 11, the court shall issue the order if the court makes a certain finding of fact that they're not likely to reoffend. But it doesn't specifically say who has the burden of proof on that issue. And this should be something that's in the defendant's responsibility to do. So I would like to, and I don't think we want to mark the bill up today, so I'm just laying this on the table. That's one issue I have with it. A second issue I have is something I was going to give out, but we didn't give out. And this deals, and I'm going to ask Doug Willover part of this, deals with the applicability and effective dates and stuff like that. For example, in line 10 on page 2, it talks about destruction, but you don't destroy the records here. All you do is seal them. And I have a real question as to, I'd like, frankly, to have this available for people who've already been convicted, and the bill doesn't do that. Third, the DPS has a fiscal note that raises all kinds of questions, and we need to address those. And, Mr. Chair, I hope that we do the bulk of this in this committee, because this deals with the way the bill's going to actually be put into operation, and I'll let it go with that.
Okay, thank you. So what I would like to do is have it so that when we work with your office to send the copy with amendments to the troopers in the court system for their comment and revised fiscal notes, we can have the amendments, the proposed amendments at that time so that they'll be able to comment on those amendments. If they're significant amendments, I mean, we don't mind comma changes and those kind of things. But so right now what I'm seeing is that we have amendments proposed. They have preponderance of the evidence set on page 1, line 11. I think it's been identified that we need a limitation on liability mm-hmm. to the state yeah. is going to be another section we're going to need. And then the third section that you just identified, Representative Grimberg, could you restate that?
It deals with the applicability section.
Okay, applicability to past people that have set-asides and whether those can be expunged. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, what I'd like to do is to work with the sponsor and anybody else on the committee who's interested mm-hmm. and come up with a proposed CS.
That would be fine. What I want to do is get the items that we're looking at in this so that we can get a fiscal note question going forward. Representative Elkins, did you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Grimberg?
I think that before we ask for the fiscal note, we'll work with the sponsor on this and your staff. We need to know exactly what we're going to do because the real question is how this is going to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is what State Affairs is going to be looking at as well, as to see is this workable to, I mean, the destruction of documents there on page 2, line 10, that's a question, or sealing of documents, and maybe that's just a word change, but we will need to look at that and talk with the department. So does anyone have any further comments on this bill? Yes.
Does Mr. Williver, is he just here to answer questions?
Yes, he's here to answer questions.
Because I would prefer, I don't know if he wants to say anything, but if we can, I would suggest that we get a working group of these parts of the administration, and if the staff can help us do that through this committee.
And the sponsor is willing to
yeah.
do that and take it. And Mr. Williver, are you online?
Yes. Can you hear me, Mr. Chair?
We sure can. Are there any comments you want to make on this bill? I presume that you've heard where we're going and talking on this. And the do you have the CS version Y?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have Y, but I talked with Linda this morning, and I have the essence of Y. I had an earlier draft. It's very similar to Y. So I know what you're looking at.
Okay. Did you have any comments you needed to make, or will you be available to work with the sponsor, Representative Grimberg, and my staff on this?
Mr. Chairman, I could make comments, but if this is a work in progress, I've worked with Linda already on this bill, and I don't anticipate having any problems doing that. I would ask to participate, and I can work with Representative Grimberg, the sponsor, and anybody else who'd like to work on the bill.
Appreciate your participation in that, and we'll be getting with you on timing for that. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House Bill 34? Is there anyone else online? So at this time, I'll close the public testimony, and we will put aside House Bill 34, and working group will work on that one. So now Representative Grimberg.
Since I'm the only one that's really talked about this, is there anybody else on the committee who's interested in having their staff or themselves participate? If they are, they can just contact us.
Sure. Yeah, well, they can contact my staff here on sure. State Affairs, and we'll let the offices know when we're going to have a meeting anyway, so that anybody that decides they want to participate can. Let's take a 2 minute at ease while we shuffle around here. Probably three. HB 238, and we've been talking about the medical element, and of course, for everybody's information, what we're doing is looking at the medical element that we had in 238, and we also have now passed over from the Senate, we have 141, which had a medical element very similar to 191, House Bill 191. But what we're trying to do is, time is getting short. We've discussed a number of times the medical elements, and we want to look at the plan that we have and figure out if there, if the committee can come to a decision on what philosophical direction on the medical benefits they want to go. Katie, can you lead us through these handouts that we have?
For the record, Katie Shaw, staff representative, Seton. The first handout you have is titled PERS, Possible Medical Scenarios for a Member Before Medicare Eligible. And I gotta, it says do not lean into.
Just the volume up just a little bit.
Or microphone closer to the
This is what we're looking at. You have this?
Yeah, it's just,
it was right on top. When I came back a minute ago, Chair.
Right there.
Which one? That's what we're looking at.
I think this.
And basically what this chart does is it extrapolates data from the chart prepared by Mercer that we handed out on Thursday. It looks like this. And there are extra copies in the hall if someone needs them.
Okay. So just for clarification, the Mercer charts were those 15 pages of charts that were these different scenarios for early retirees, late retirees, 1%, 2%, all those calculations. Go ahead, Kate.
And because those charts on the early hire scenarios only depicted retiring at age 55, we wanted to reflect a retiree who would work until age 60, which would be a much more reasonable scenario. So you have in the first chart, PERS other early hire, 30 years, and retires at 60. So retiring at 60 under HB 238, they would receive a 90% subsidy.
I'm sort of lost here. May I just interrupt with a question?
Sure, Representative Grunberg.
Okay. We have, are we still working off the L version?
We're working off, what we're talking about now is just the medical elements of 238. That's this, these that we were given, and then these here.
Okay, so we're working on those. Okay, thank you.
And you will see that the cost of medical, this is the entire cost of the premiums between the ages of 60 months before Medicare eligible and Medicare eligible age is $304,491. Then the next line down is the amount of subsidy, and that's the amount that the system would pay on behalf of the retiree based on their 30 years of service and 90% subsidy, and that is $200,739. Then the amount of their premium paid by their health reimbursement account, which would be collected at 2% through the course of their employment, is $160,578. So when you take the cost of the medical and you subtract the amount of the subsidy that the plan would pay for and the amount that the retiree's HRA would pay for, the net out-of-pocket expense to the retiree for their 60 months pre-Medicare medical coverage would actually be minus $56,826, which means they would carry that money forward to be able to spend post-Medicare eligible age, or they could spend those funds on co-pays, similar medical, qualified medical expenses.
Okay, so sometimes these negatives and positives get to us. So on this negative, it means that when you subtract those out, it means that there's still $56,000 mm-hmm. in the health reimbursement account for that employee.
Are these changes to these charts here? Is that what's going
on? Those are set forward to age retirement at age 60. So for the early hires on those charts have retirement at 65. And that's what we talked about the other day, was that the system basically cannot support retirement at earlier ages because there's so much of the money is going to have to be put out by the individual retiree that they're going to be basically out of the system, and therefore then they wouldn't have any future medical benefits.
So this, what you're giving out today, is supplementary to what you've given out before, and the difference is it assumes the hypothetical that the person is retiring at 60 rather than at 65, is that what's
rather going? Than 55.
Rather than 55.
For the early hires, as you'll see in your chart, and the page number is just down below it there. So if you want to correspond days, you can look to page 2 of the chart package. And you'll see that chart package has, in the second column down there, the age of retirement at 55.
This says 50. Oh, I see.
I see. Worked 30 years and retired at age 55.
I see.
And then what you do is you look over and you see that there's this large gap of money gap that the retiree would run out of his health care reimbursement account over on the right-hand side.
Where it says which one? Retiree subsidy? Is that what you're looking at?
Right. The retiree subsidy doesn't kick in until 60 months before Medicare.
Okay.
But their HRA on the right-hand side, you see they would use that all up in 3.5 years.
I see.
And so they'd have 2 years of $50,000 payments, which is basically the amount of their full retirement that would have to go into paying that premium, which means that what this creates is a very good medical benefit, but it doesn't cover someone retiring at the age 55. It will not cover them through. Now, if someone had medical benefits through a spouse or some other coverage that they didn't need to cover that, then that would work.
Mr. Chair, it looks on page 2 under retiree contribution like for the first 5 years the retiree is going to have to contribute between $40,000 and $50,000 according to this chart here every year for 5 years.
That's correct, and they have the $160,000 in their HRA account over at the right-hand side, and so that HRA is paying those payments.
Now, I don't see $160,000.
That's the total of the...
Oh, the total. I see. The total up at the top says $165.79. Yeah. Okay.
And so that pays off those, but then you run out of that before you reach even the subsidy age, and then you would still be having to make the payments, the retiree contribution, third column from the left.
So 1 year you're going to have to spend almost $52,000 out of your own pocket.
That's right. And that's why we've taken these and this is the Mercer generated calculations, and we've said the plan that we're creating under HB 238 does not provide medical coverage for a person to come in at age 25, retire at 55, and provide enough money for them to have medical insurance all the way through. The charts that you have before you now is that if you go to 60 and retire at age 60, then you end up with even having your HRA pay all those expenses. You still, when you hit 65 and into Medicare, you still have $56,000 in your HRA, in addition to the subsidy that will be paid at Medicare eligible.
So you would retain 56,826.
That's correct. And still be able to retire at 60 or 60 months pre-Medicare coverage. Does that make sense? I mean, we may as well understand one of these before we go to the other ones.
Be sure, better.
Then the next chart, you want to go through the other scenarios there?
Sure. The second chart down is PERS other late hire, 20 years, retires at 60, with spouse, 60% subsidy. So this assumes that a retiree works for 20 years and also has a spouse to cover it through their retirement. The cost of the medical insurance would be $290,000, $290,044. The amount of the subsidy would be $128,745. That's applied to both the spouse and the member. And the amount paid by the HRA would be $54,563. Therefore, to cover both participants, the out-of-pocket expense to the retiree to cover those two participants 60 months before Medicare eligible age would be $106,736. If you go down to the third scenario, it's the PERS other late hire, 20 years, retires at age 60 and has 60% of subsidy but without the spouse. And if you'll just go down to the net out-of-pocket expense for that retiree, it's $21,113. The next page is the same scenario for TERS employees. So the first chart has a TERS early hire, 30 years, retires at Medicare eligible age, and there's a receives a 90% subsidy. So if you go down to their net out-of-pocket expense, they would retain $113,086. Therefore, they would have that money after they hit Medicare eligible age.
And Katie, just backing up for a minute. Now, the main difference between the TERS contribution having $113,000 left in their HRA and the PERS employee having 56. What's that difference based on?
The difference is based on that on TERS have a higher salary amount, so that their average HRA, their HRA is larger because the percentage that's put into that account is more. So if you'll see on the PERS, the first PERS chart, the amount paid by the HRA is $160,578, whereas on the TERS first chart, it's $213,838. The second chart on...
Before we go on, I just want to make sure that everybody understands that difference is, and that's why these are broken out into different sections. There's a TERS, PERS, police and fire, and PERS other. They're basically three different classes within the retirement system that have different eligibilities, and they also have different average salaries. And I just want to remind everyone that under the HRA, even though that says a 2%, it's not 2% of your individual salary, because that's illegal for the anti-discrimination clauses. That's 2% of the average salary of that group of employees. So all employees that are in TERS are going to be, doesn't matter what your individual salary is for that year, everyone is going to get the same HRA contribution, because under the anti-discrimination clauses in the U.S. federal government, you can't discriminate between people on those Medicare, on the HRA contributions based on their salary. So this is, even though it says 2%, it's 2% of an average salary, and everybody gets it, whether you're an incoming person or you've been there and you're a $100,000 person. The same amount of contribution goes into the HRA. Now, that's not the same with the percentage that goes into your subsidy amount. You are actually putting in a percentage of salary, the 3.75, 3.5. Those are based on actual salary percentage. Yes, Representative Grimberg.
Mr. Chair, I may have missed something, but you said that we can't do something because it's illegal under federal law.
That's correct.
Has that been described to the committee before?
Yes, it has, Representative Grimberg. On the HRA, when Melanie Milhorn was here as well, we talked about it because there's the anti-discriminatory provisions for an HRA means that you cannot base an HRA contribution for an employee on their individual salary, on a difference between their salary and somebody else. Going into the into an HRA, there is a okay. federal limitation that it can't be discriminatory based on how much you earn. Mm-hmm. So this is a restriction on the employer themselves as to what they can do, and that's the way the HRA works. Representative Gardner.
And one other point, just to check my understanding, that these scenarios that we have before us now assume retirement, Medicare eligibility at 65, and we anticipate that that's going to change very shortly. Correct. So these are just examples of how the system works, because it's going to change by a couple of years.
Actually, if you look at all of these scenarios, they are scenarios for member before Medicare eligibility. It's 60 months, 5 years before Medicare mm-hmm. eligibility, so that as the Medicare system changes, we've incorporated those in here. One of the big points that we were trying to do in the medical portion was not generate unfunded liabilities in the future.
Right, exactly. But in this example, retires at 60, for example.
Right.
If the Medicare eligibility changes, in order for this to hold, it would have to be retires at 62.
That's correct. And if you look down at the bottom there, it says retiree at 60 month pre-Medicare.
Right.
And so whenever you see 60 here, 60 is not in the bill, and it's kind of
60
our.
60 months before.
It's
Medicare.
60 months before Medicare eligibility, and we've tried to incorporate that in as many places mm-hmm. as we can, so everybody understands that it's not age 60. It's right. just currently age 60, but the bill is 60 months pre mm-hmm. Medicare eligibility. Okay. Anybody have any other questions before we go on that one? Okay, go ahead, Katie.
Let's see, I believe we're on the second chart on this page, which is the TERS late hire, 20 years, and retires at Medicare, 60 months pre-Medicare eligible age with a 60% subsidy. If you go down to net out-of-pocket expense, it's $1,131. And the last chart is a late hire with spouse, so it assumes 20 years of employment and a 60% subsidy. And the net out-of-pocket expense for those two members for those 60 months would be $89,198.
And as we all know, we hate talking about these medical expenses being inflated the way they are, but seems to be the only way we can talk about them 20 or 30 years in advance. So, I mean, these remember, the generation of all these are based on the current assumptions that we're working under the retirement plan. That is 12% for the next 2 years and 11% and 10% for a couple years. And then going down in 12 years, going down to 5% medical escalation.
Are you on a particular page there?
They're all the same, yeah. If you look at page 2, for example, and look at the middle block there where it says pre-MC, that's pre-Medicare composite premium, and then you look right next to it, the composite trend, that trend is the inflation increase. So that we're talking about for next year, the inflation was 2 years from when the study was done, which was talking about 12%, which was adopted in 2002, 12% medical inflation for 2 years, and then it goes down to 11%, and then 10% for a couple years, and then 9%, and then in 12 years out here, it goes to 5% of medical inflation. And that's what the actuarials did, just because basically they're saying, you know, if it kept growing at 10%, pretty soon we'd have more in our medical inflation than we would have in the gross domestic product. And so at some point in time, it just can't. Whether we like those numbers or not is, or like the way we get there. We can discuss those. Yes, Representative Gruenberg.
We have been concerned about the accuracy of the actuarial figures. I mean, that's sort of underlain part of the thinking that may be part of the reason, not all the reason, but part of the reason we're in the pickle we're in. And it seems to me that this pre-Medicare composite trend column, which is almost entirely, it seems, developed by actuaries, may be very, very inaccurate. And if we're really talking, blaming some boards on relying too much on inaccurate actuarial assumptions, this may be stepping into the same trap, because it seems to me that it is very unlikely that these are going to be accurate. How can we examine this column more closely? And, you know, you may say this may overshadow the entire domestic product or whatever. Then that may be, that may not, it, in fact, it may be that the domestic product will have to grow to keep up with this or something. But, I mean, that seems to be trying to adjust your body to fit the size of the bed in the Procrustean sense.
Well, we do have the Milliman audit that you have of Mercer's, and we can pull that one out and take a look at their audit of it. I don't know how to audit it anymore. We've got we're developing on the trends. Those are the trends we adopted. Now, remember that our plan here has the subsidy base, and the reason we're showing these is that what we've done is we've constrained the growth of what we will subsidize by 5% a year. So if it grows larger than 5% a year, then there is going to be more that the employee is going to be at risk. We've designed the system here to say that it's the growth of healthcare costs is limited to 5%. That's why this is the defined dollar contribution, because we have put in there and said whatever premiums grow to, that we're going to cover 90% of that. We're covering, if someone worked for 30 years, we're covering 90% of the healthcare costs, but limited to a 5% growth rate, so we know what those costs will be to the system.
It seems to me, if I may.
Sure. Representative Gruenberg.
That, you know, we've talked a lot in the legislature the last few years about the difficulty of basing a budget on anything more than current estimates, because we don't know in that case about the price of oil. There's an unknown variable. It's kind of irrelevant what the unknown variable is. In this case, the unknown variable we're dealing with is the cost of future health care. And that's what makes planning. This is a type of fiscal planning. It just happens to be a variation on a common theme. And it makes it very difficult. And that's why I think it's extremely important, since we're here, the seven of us, as we used to say on the bridge, we're on watch and the ship's in our care. Maybe we're not the best, but we are the people who have the con, you know, at this point with this legislation. Maybe I'd like to really think on if we're having difficulty predicting. Maybe what we need to do is to go on the assumption, a different assumption, that we can't predict, that it's going to be very difficult, except I think we can predict that it's going to go up. And we have to figure maybe in more of a short term or some flexibility into the system. Otherwise,
as you said only yesterday, private employers go bankrupt when this occurs. We're not going to go bankrupt. The state of Alaska, God forbid, won't go bankrupt. But maybe we need to have something built into the system, into this legislation, or whatever legislation we're dealing with, that, and as you know, I have some problems with this bill, this whole concept. But it's a problem that goes beyond the bill itself. It's difficult to predict, and maybe we need to have something in there that requires the government every few years to re-examine this. Like we're talking about in the fiscal plan legislation, that the legislature shall every year examine its fiscal plan. Maybe we need something in here that says that every year or every couple of years, the legislature shall re-examine their health care plan.
And that would be fine. I think we'll find that that's what SB 141 is trying to get to in the reconstruction of the board and the requirements on the new board. And I'm sure Senator Stedman will be presenting 141, and he's in the audience. You're welcome to come up and join us up here as well.
He's smiling and shaking his head. The record should reflect that.
That's okay. Those are elements that we've all been looking at, trying to get a closer handle and trying to do that. And so, but you know where we're stuck is that we are making estimates, and we have a plan that is based on estimates. So the question is, you know, how do we get a plan that works well, that provides benefits, that attracts and retains employees, and has some fiscal stability to it? And could we generate the plan that we have now? Are we saying that it's a default? It's where we want to be? I mean, if we would look at it now, I don't think anyone, or very many people, would generate that plan based on any of the assumptions that were, or any of the numbers we're looking at. So if we don't do something, we are basically saying we are going forward with the plan that we have now, meaning we cover all medical costs. And so if we adopt or don't adopt, we're making choices. And so what I want to do is get the choices on the table so that we all understand them and we make those decisions, and then we can make that decision. Yes, Representative Gardner.
In that vein, the way I see it, the choices are that either the state has known costs and the employees' costs vary according to what the true costs are, or the employee has set costs and the states vary, which is the way we've pretty much done it, or they share the risk. But the plan that protects the employer and the state by limiting costs is a discouragement under a current system for attraction, retention, and recruitment and retention of employees, unless pay scales are higher. So we're sort of over a hurdle. We've had a lot of testimony from people who say they deal with the lower pay scales in exchange for secure retirement. And if we build in additional costs in retirement, then we have to give more money up front or they won't stay.
Well, and I would just say that, you know, if we look at these charts here, mm-hmm. and you see that you have pre-60 months before Medicare eligibility, medical, and the system has provided enough money through the HRA that you can, if you've been there 30 years, not only will you pay all of the premiums, but you will also have $56,000 in PERS or $113,000 in TERS left to carry into Medicare eligibility, mm-hmm. as well as then having the Medicare component that's built into here as well. I mean, that's no small shake for a medical plan. I mean, you know, even in the other ones where you have a spouse, you're covering, you know, 67% of the total medical. So I guess we have to weigh apples. We have to say, you know, what we want to compare to and what we want to be able to afford to do.
But all of this is for, or much of this is for somebody who's worked for 30 years. And in our society today, how many people stay 30 years in the same job?
Sure. We have two of each of these are 20 years, and one of them is 30 years. But, yeah, you're right. Representative Lynn.
Is there any way, I'm trying to think outside the box, you know, we have variable rate mortgages, et cetera, based upon, you know, how things change, interest rates go up and down. And so is there any way to link any of this so that contributions from employer and employee would vary according to what the actual medical cost, et cetera, are? Am I completely off base here? Where we wouldn't have to rely so much on making guesstimates of what medical costs may be 15 years from now. Who knows?
Now, Mr. Chair, you've talked in terms of a variable. You've built at least one variable into the system in that you don't have age 60 or whatever. You have 60 months before Medicare kicks in. What you've done is built in a variable, a floater. And what Representative Lynn is suggesting, and at least it's something that really may have some benefits, is allow other kinds of floaters too. I mean, let's think outside the box if we're going to solve this kind of a problem.
Well, Representative Lynn, the subsidy is 90%. If you've been there 30 years, it's 3% per year. So if you've been there 20 years, it's 60%. So that's 60% of the premium cost. It is limited to 5% per year over the 30 years, escalating. But that does take up as a percentage. It's not a fixed dollar. It's a limited dollar, but it is a contribution that does change as a percentage of the medical cost. If that's what you were.
Well, I'm just trying to just think of something new that we haven't talked about, because actuarial tables, you know, we're contacting the psychic network here on what we're going to try. And I'd like to do something a little more concrete.
That's great.
Right. Representative Kelly, did you have a comment?
Just that in a time when the medical component inflation rate is so out of control, it doesn't matter whether you divide by two or what you do. The thing is so overwhelming in future dollars that it behooves the legislature, in my opinion, to be as conservative as you can at a time when we just got here on a bus that's a defined benefit bus that delivered to us. What if we don't do something this year? We'll come back and we'll be over $6 billion. And so I urge you to be extremely conservative on the theory that, given our Constitution, or at least likely interpretation of this, once you lock it in, that is going to be locked in and remembered for all time to come for that new class of employee. But if you're extremely conservative in this time, then you can always sweeten it up. And remembering that it's for the next person in the door who's typically young, mobile, going to change positions several times. And so I think you're on the right track to be very conservative at this point. And I guess the Senate bill is more conservative than this cut at it. And I guess I just get more comfortable as you make it more conservative, because we can tune it over time. You can spend 5 years tuning it or 20 years tuning it. What you cannot do if you make the mistake of putting a DB in this thing that exposes us to the same risk that we've had, you will make a forever mistake. But if you are very conservative and take that DB out of it, then you are able to enhance that plan however you want. And it's my theory remains that the young folks coming in the door, that isn't what drives them. And the numbers show that. They're brought in the door by other things, and Rep. Gardner makes a good point on the pay. We will have to address competitive pay. So I urge you to be conservative in this and absolutely to get on with getting a DB in place this year.
Okay, and
all right, DC.
Yeah.
We knew you meant that.
Yeah. May I respond?
Just a moment. I just want to recognize that Representative Wilson has joined us, and we have a chair up here if you'd like to join us, or if you're happy back there, glad you could come. Go ahead, Representative Gruenberg, then Elkins.
Just one thing that Representative Kelly, you said. That has not been my experience, but it is testable. You have said that you didn't think that retirement benefits bring people into the system. Maybe I'm misstating you. I think that is an absolutely essential issue that we must at least take a look at. And I have been told by many people that in fact the retirement benefits today are a major factor in bringing and retaining people in the system. And if we disagree on that point, then I think it's worth our doing some checking on that. If that is one of the fundamental assumptions in your logical reasoning here, if that would make a difference to you. And I think that maybe we need to have some more testimony on that, because I'm told, in fact, that's a major factor.
Okay, and I just would like to say that I think there's two different issues that are talked about here. One is attracting people to the system, and the other is retaining people in the system. And I think we need to make sure that we keep sure. those straight, because as Representative Kelly and myself and everyone else knows, that retention in the system, as people get older, retirement benefits and medical benefits become much more important. And I think that Representative Kelly was talking about a young person being attracted into the state of Alaska, into employment at the first. But do you want to respond, or is that?
Just very quickly, sir, because I know you're in a hurry. You can get a ton of, with due respect, you can get a ton of testimony that sounds the bell that we just can't possibly do this with a DC, and I think you have to be aware of where that testimony is coming from. As someone who was interested in getting the best and the brightest and holding on to them, I do not believe that people coming into the system, and again, the younger ones coming in, as they get older, they get much more interested in it. But in this time, when we have this coming up on $6 billion unfunded liability, I think we need to remember that we're protecting the existing employees. We're locking that in. That is taken care of. We're not harming them. The next person that stands at the door comes in knowing what the arrangement is, and I just urge you to keep as much risk out of the equation as possible, because that's how we got here. We got on the risk bus, and there are 50 states grappling with the same things.
And before I go on to Representative Elkins and Lynn, I do want to make sure that everybody realizes that the plan that we've got here in 238 that we've been talking about is a divine dollar plan. That's where it's got that 5% escalator in there, so that we have limited the unfunded liability going forward, because we know what that liability will be. It's a maximum of 5% per year increase. So that's the entire intent. And we do need to look at the other proposals that are here, and I'm sure Representative Stedman or Senator Stedman will address it on Tuesday. But if you have a plan that is just post-Medicare and you don't have a defined dollar contribution in there, you have an unfunded liability built into that system, like in 191, because depending upon the changes in Medicare, the state may be liable for picking up all of the escalation in there, and we may have an unfunded liability portion that we need to look at in that kind of scenario as well. So that's a defined dollar contribution, the 5% escalator that continues through Medicare as well in in this plan. So, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to clarify something, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Mr. President Kelly on the fact that I think when you're young, you're interested in dollars in the pocket and money to buy a home with and that. But getting back to, I think, a statement you said that you it was to get this out, were you assuming that you were saying by the end of session? Because I've been a strong advocate in this committee to tweak it as much as we can, but I don't see how we can get a document that we can really and truly be proud of out in 20-some days. I mean, not that we haven't been working on it, because I know when the House and Senate decided, we put there's been a lot of time put in. But I'd sure rather see us put together a good capable task force and work on it this summer and pass something the first part of next session. But just some comments on that.
Just I appreciate the comments, but I really want to have the committee work through as far and as fast as it can, so we have the options. If we slow down, then it limits our options as well. Representative Kelly.
Just comment on that. I think that the work, the hundreds of hours of work in the Senate and as well as over here, the fact that there are defined contribution plans all over the country, everybody's grappling with this. It's a matter of whether you want to buckle under the pressure, in my opinion, and ship it forward into an election year, and you're going to end up all balled up and we won't get a darn thing done. So I guess I just am a strong advocate of we'll put a new board in place with the bill. That will give that new board the charge of tuning if we have to tune, and if we've got a slack, we've got zippers on this thing. So if we have to make it better, run that zipper up a couple, you know, a percent or so, and from 2 to 3 or something. But it we can do it if we have the will.
Representative Lynn.
Well, I just wonder, harkening back to something you said earlier, has there been any kind of studies whatsoever on the motivation of new employees, not just anecdotal tales from people who may testify here, who have a dog in the fight, but some kind of polling, is that, you know how many people go in for this or go in for that. I know that in almost any retirement, just military, pursers, whatever, the closer you get to retirement, the more likely you are to stay in there. It just makes sense. Going to the election year, I
don't want to get too far away from our subject of going here, so you can go ahead.
Well, go ahead. Point I want to make, I don't think we should vote yay and nay on this or any other bill in the legislature based upon what is and is not in an election year.
Okay. Thank you. And, I appreciate that sentiment. I do want to let you know that in the State Affairs packet, that book that we had, and we can get you another one if your staff find it there. There's the employer and employee surveys. We've got all those that were done on the. You got to remember that most of this work was done in the TIER task force that met over a whole previous year from the PERS and TERS boards, did those surveys, did those developments. And so we'll make sure you get those. And anybody else that doesn't have them.
I'd like to know do we have those?
Okay. Katie.
Heath is going to try and get us some copies of a study on recruitment for teachers. And it does reflect that for beginning teachers, salary is far more important than benefits. And he's working right now to get that for the committee.
Thank you. And thank you, Heath, for getting that for us. So we have these two, one for PERS, one for TERS. We didn't generate the one on PERS others. It's going to look like fairly similar to TERS because it has the higher salaries. And anyway, we'll come back to those in a minute. Let's take a look. Let's go on. First of all, let's look at, we'll steal one of the Senate's Finance Committee, the March 31st comparison of states' normal age retirement, age and service. Just so everybody has this one here. Just because we've been talking about age of retirement, whether 55 or 60, and you'll see that over there that about the fourth column over there, you'll see that over half of the states have 65 as the age of retirement. And Alaska is down there, you'll see it, I lost it.
It's about three quarters, 80% of the way down.
Yeah, it's about three quarters, and we're at 60 and five, or all 30 at any age retirement. We've got several different tiers, so it's changed there. For teachers, it's 60 with 8 years or 20 years at any age, and then PERS, which is on the right-hand side there, 65. That was tier one, I believe, and any age at 30. So that's where we're getting our 30 years, which is our current and what we do. Yes, Representative Groomer.
Where's the federal government?
I have no idea.
I'd like to, if somebody asks staff, if somebody can find out where they would fit on this. The reason I'm saying that is because our competition isn't with Vermont, but maybe with the federal government.
Sure. We'll get that information. Katie, do you want to go on and go through? We have two of them. One's labeled A and one's labeled B. And that's talking about the medical system we have proposed in 238.
The first side here, labeled A, is the major medical as laid out in HB 238. And everyone should be relatively familiar with this as we've been discussing it for a while. But just to highlight a few of the points, under HB 238, insurance coverage is for the eligible member includes their member's spouse and dependents. However, they all have to be dependents while the member was an active employee. We discussed that thoroughly in previous committees. Also noted that each member will have to pay a separate premium with their subsidy based on the member's years of service. So the cost doubles, triples, depending on how many dependents one has. Retirees, the requirement for becoming eligible for the medical plan is 30 years of service and retiring directly from the system, or having at least 10 years of service and 60 months pre-Medicare, the age 60 months pre-Medicare eligible. If you have 30 years of service and have not reached the age of 60 months before pre-Medicare eligible, you have access only to the medical plan until you reach that age. And that access only means you pay 100% of the premium for you and your dependents. The retirees become eligible for the subsidy, which is a percentage subsidy of a subsidy base. The subsidy base will be established the year that the legislation becomes enacted and then increases by no more than 5% every year. And for every additional year of service after 10 years of service, the retiree is eligible for a 3% increment in the percentage subsidy on that's applied to that subsidy base. And you'll see a table of the percentages below just to kind of spell out a little more clearly how many years of service and what the percentage, employee percentage of premium would be.
And just, I think Representative Gardner had a question.
Yes, I do, and it has to do with access to the system and eligibility for subsidy. And I believe that under the proposed plan, if the retiree does not keep up with their premium costs, they lose access to the system. And that means they also lose the 60-month subsidy prior to Medicare. Is that correct?
That is correct. If there's a 60-day threshold, and if they don't make their payment, they will lose access. Mm-hmm. That really, what that does is it encourages employment up to age 60. And if a retiree, let's say, serves 30 years and then retires early, they have to be able to bridge the gap between their early retirement age mm-hmm. and 60 months pre-Medicare with some other qualified medical insurance. So they have to prove coverage.
Yeah, and I just wanted to insert that you don't have to have this medical coverage. If you have medical coverage through a spouse, if you have other medical coverage through a previous employment or something, all you have to do is show that you are covered medically so that you don't have people retire and then not take care of their medical expenses, acquire illnesses but not want to get treatment because they're not covered, and so they wait and wait and not get that preventative care and then come in with a huge load of medical expenses and illnesses that have gone forward because they weren't covered for medical expenses previous to that. So there's just two ways of doing it. You can either, you know, if you retire at 55 and you can either pay your medical expenses, your HRA will help, you'll eat it up fairly fast as the projections show, but you can also, if you are covered by some other medical policy, that serves the same thing. You don't have to make that payment. You just have to show that you have medical coverage, adequate medical coverage, and this also gives you access so that you don't have to go out and try and find a personal loan policy, and you can have access to the state policy at the state rate. So that in itself is a huge benefit if someone wants to retire early, but it's going to take a lot of calculation. If someone wants to, like the previous chart said, if they come in at age 25 and work 30 years and want to retire after age 55, the projections are that it's going to eat up all of their HRA. They're going to have significant other money to dump into the plan to maintain medical coverage. If they've got medical coverage through a spouse, then it's taken care of.
I guess it seems sort of unfair to me, though, if an employee in 30 years has earned that 60 months pre-Medicare coverage, and if they can't afford to keep the premiums up for that 10 or 12 years between retirement and Medicare eligibility, it costs them that entire 60 months. And it seems like, if they've already earned it, you're taking away something that they've already earned simply because they can't keep up coverage in the interim. And as you said, it's an incentive to keep working, but it seems to sort of unfairly stack the deck in favor of the employer.
Well, Representative Gardner, I don't think the intent is to stack the deck for the employer. The intent is to say that the employee cannot go out and get a whole lot of non-serviced medical conditions and then come back in and say, oh, I haven't maintained active coverage by keeping my employment or being employed someplace else where I had medical coverage or by being covered under somebody else's policy, and now I want to bring this 5-year accumulated load of unserviced medical costs and shift it into the system. Mm-hmm. So that's where the retiring directly out of the system comes from. And, you know, it's a conundrum. I don't know how to solve it. I mean, I wish there was some way to do that without breaking the bank. And so right. far, that's a bit of a problem.
Preventative medicine.
Preventative medicine is correct. Yes, Representative Lynn.
Well, I'm just going to follow up. The intent is not as important as what actually happens. It doesn't matter what the intent is, what happens to the employee.
Sure. And I, you know, the way I look at it, 30 years from now, employees are going to have a very definite incentive to stay employed. If they've qualified in this system, they're going to make sure that they stay employed in another system where they have health care or some way of covering other than using their HRA. Using it all up, because as we know, medical expenses increase over time. I think that anyone that's being, you know, fiduciary responsibility is going to probably maintain, stay working another 5 years to make sure that they have all that built up HRA to carry into an extended retirement age. But
I just want to speak to the intent.
Sure.
The intent is irrelevant as far as the employee, the patient is concerned.
Yeah. Representative Gardner.
I probably should know the answer to this, but maybe you do. Can HRA funds be used for insurance premiums?
Yes. Yes, and in fact, that's where...
That's where the costs come out?
That's where, as you see all these columns where they're using them, that's the first use of those is for the premiums cost. Yeah. But you can also use it for any other medical deductibles, right. Copays, anything. It's dollars basically in your pocket to expend on any qualified medical expense.
And insurance
is a qualified medical expense. Representative Grunberg.
We're talking about a hypothetical as though the only people who come in or who should be coming into the system are the very young. As we have this problem going throughout society, people age, and people will want to have second careers. What are we going to do to attract those people? Are they going to be able to come in midstream into the state? Or are they going to be discouraged because they'll never get enough, never be able to have a portable health care system?
Well, Representative Grunberg, if you look at the tables of the PERS and TERS, of the six blocks generated there, four of them are 20 years coming in at age 40. So, unfortunately, the person at Mercer that does these charts, the actuarial isn't around it this whole week, right?
He's retired?
Retired, yes. and so we don't have a 10-year projection here. We got a 20-year. 10 years a minimum at which you can qualify for medical payments. But if you look at the chart, you can see that the late hires had more coverage. They used up their HRAs less quickly. Anyway, if you look at number 9, I think you'll see that there's still some HRA left there in police and fire at 2%. Now, again, that's a 20-year. That's in at 40. And we could run a 10-year because that's a minimum amount that you could generate. Yes. Page number 9 on the Mercer 15 pages that we had.
I don't see many 40-year-old people going to become firemen. But I could see them becoming teachers.
And another one here that's late hire, 2% is table 14, I believe. In fact, I think we've got that.
For legislators.
If you look at the second page of this one, where it says TRS at the top.
Yep.
The middle one there is for a person coming in at age 40 and working for 20 years. And you'll see that the net out-of-pocket expense, if they retired at age 60, or really 60 months pre-Medicare eligible, their total cost out-of-pocket would be $1,131. So, you know, they're actually a 20-year teacher. That's what they would have to be eligible to retire. They would have to have, and it's pretty well covers everything. Representative Kelly.
Just the Hilltop question about what about these people that will be changing careers much more often and coming in.
Yeah.
I'm a good example. I've switched 3 times in just the last 5 years, mm-hmm. you know, and it is absolutely true that the more that the pension and the health plan are owned by the employee and portable, the better it addresses what Representative Grunberg was mentioning, the ability to switch, because you own what you have, including what the employer put in, including all the accumulated earnings on that, and you can move it. So if you have whether it's a pension that you can move anywhere you go, or elements of a health care plan that have the HRA that you also own to apply against costs. The more portable those are, the more it addresses what Representative Grunberg spoke to.
You know, that's an issue that really hasn't been discussed all that much that I've heard. And one thing that we have as a society that ages gracefully and lives longer is the desire to have several careers and to have various life experiences. It's called a midlife crisis, but it's really a midlife opportunity.
Right.
It really is. It's an opportunity to do things you haven't done before, rather than being, quote, tied to the land or tied to your job. And that's something that is very important personally to many people. And that is, if that is in fact the case, that is something that needs to be carefully explained to Alaskans.
Thank you. And the if we look at that again, down at the bottom of that page, it goes through all of the changes. We're talking about the page A that says major medical benefits in House Bill 238. So that intermediate portion gives you all the percentages of what you earn over each year. In other words, after 10 years, you've got 70%. The employee is getting 30% from the employer, and the employee is paying 70%. And then it earns all the way up with 30 years employment for the employee only pays 10%, and the employer pays 90%. And of course, this is one of the things that was identified with the employers. Surveys was that they wanted to have incentive for long-term employees, and that's why it comes up to 90% there. Yes, Representative Gardner.
And is the premium, again, an element and a factor that can vary from year to year?
The premium that is the subsidy base is variable up to 5% a year. Escalate up to 5% a year. Could it escalate more than that in some years or less than that in other years? Yes. And if it does escalate to more than, if it was 7% some year, then what would happen was there would be 2% that the employee would have to pick up.
So even with the state subsidy increasing by 3% each year, the employee could be out of pocket more each year too, paying into it.
That's correct. That's correct. And that's where this defined dollar contribution or a defined dollar healthcare plan came from, because you know you're paying the 90%, but there is a limit, or 3% more per year, but there is a limitation that the healthcare premium subsidy base can't increase more than 5%.
Thank you.
Okay, and then you see the contribution rates. These are based on 2% for the employer, major medical, and is 3.75 for TERS and 3.5 for PERS. And again, like the numbers up above showed, that it favors long-term employees, and it will encourage employment to the 60-month pre-Medicare eligible age. And then we have a comparison of the other plans, what they've proposed on B. This was also similar to 191, but 141, which you have a copy to study over the weekend here, is only after 65. Okay, there's no pre-65, no pre-Medicare age eligibility. However, as you see the premium amounts that are in there, they are higher, so that the employee percentage of premium, if you work 10 years, is 30%. So the employer is covering 70% of the Medicare age, post-Medicare age premium, and then it goes up by 5% increments to the 90% for the employer to pay. So there's less difference between the two plans in the length of service and the subsidy you'll get. So that's another question there. And of course, you see that the major medical contribution here is 175, And that, the reason for that is there is no pre-Medicare, there's no 60 months before Medicare eligibility component at all in that plan. That's only post-Medicare retirement. So I guess the question that we've been having each one of these times that we've met on trying to define where we want to, where philosophically we are on medical coverage is to figure out, do we want to look at only post-Medicare eligibility and say there's nothing? I think there's access, isn't there? There's access to the same as the average plan with the employee paying the full premium pre-Medicare eligibility. So if that's 65 or 67 or what that is, that would mean that there's the HRA, but there's no subsidy for medical treatment. And that's where we're basically at on the medical component. I mean, it's quite a difference between what we'd been talking about all along as far as being having a medical plan that was pre 65 or whether we want to just be post 65. The one thing that we do have to look at though too is that HB 238 again, and I think I stated this once, but I just wanted to bring it up again, is that post Medicare, it's still a defined dollar contribution because it limits the escalation to 5% per year. And there's no such limitation in that I see anyway, and we'll get Senator Steadman to explain this to us in a lot more detail in the post-Medicare medical that 141 has. So, do we have any ideas of how we want to proceed? Do we want to support a pre-Medicare eligible plan, or do we want to be looking at everything post-Medicare eligible? Okay. Not sure.
I'm not.
So we're not sure.
Maybe we'll get there. I'll get there. Somebody will get there quicker, probably.
Okay. Did you want to give the committee any advice?
No, sir. I've probably spoke enough today. Thank you.
One other thing that we've been looking at was DC plans in comparison with other states that had defined contribution plans. So you'll see there's a comparison chart there. And Katie, you want to run us through that quick?
Sure. The three states that have had widespread defined contribution plans are Nebraska, West Virginia, and Michigan. And a lot of people have probably noted that Nebraska and West Virginia have switched back to some type of defined benefit program recently, and I will speak to that in a minute. But basically, this lines out the different elements of the defined contribution plans in these three states. The first column is what employees are able to be in a defined contribution plan, and state and county in Nebraska, West Virginia school district employees, in Michigan, it's all public employees.
Katie, I think everybody's searching.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's the next page. It's the last page in your little paperclip packet that was handed out.
We lost that paper.
Everybody have this one? Says comparison of.
No.
No, this one.
It's.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Let's take a brief at ease.
I don't think I have.